Hello and welcome to the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy, along with a whole week's worth of excursions into the glowing embers of the cultural life of the nation, or similar. This time we're using some of our precious AliExpress PPE stash on some mask-worthy outings, from a few steps in Leopold Bloom's shoes to Corker Dorker's poetic response to the two-meter rule, as well as safely taking in an all-new Aleppo of the imagination, and checking in with Maurice Gohan. But to get us started, some statues. For Bloomsday this week, we took to the streets in a pandemic-friendly style. Culturefile's Anya Gallagher, who lives close by Leopold Bloom's house on Eccles Street, has been rambling, mic and phone in hand, the Ulysses Way, with a mind to taking in the public art mentioned in the book, all the time commentating and rambling with me at the base station here at Culturefile Towers.
I am looking for number 76 Eccles Street, number 4 where Leopold Bloom is living, so where his day begins, is directly opposite number 76, but is now the Mater Hospital, so it's not there anymore.
I guess a lot of these things will be sort of disappeared, like that they will only exist in the book.
Okay, 76. Yeah, it's a nice corner of the street. St. George's Church and Hardwick Place, just opposite, which he references as reflecting the sun, I think. But today it's a bit grey, cloudy. I think what's funny, I guess, about reading Ulysses is that many of the locations are trapped in those pages and they don't really exist now, whereas the statues, most of them are in existence still, but some have been moved. So they still hold this significance and actuality. So they're historical, really, whereas a lot of Ulysses would be deemed to be fiction. A lot of the statues are sitting on O'Connell Street, and I mean, when I was trying to think about the statues before I laid out this plan, I was really struggling to remember who was where, who was who.
We're going to see in a minute when we go down there and you go down there how they strike a contemporary pedestrian like yourself.
So I'll take Dorset Street, which I'm on now. The only fictional shop owner was on Dorset Street, and it's a butcher's where Leopold Bloom buys the kidneys that he eats for breakfast.
If you wanted to get kidneys on Dorset Street, where would you go now?
Ooh.
You don't buy a lot of kidneys yourself then?
I don't. I've never purchased a kidney. I think I'd be a bit loath to purchase one on Dorset Street, to be honest.
The thing about Ulysses is it's sort of a reading into the record of all the sort of history of the streets, like the streets becoming part of history, whereas with statuary in general, what you're trying to do is make sure that history appears in the streets.
Bloom talks about this end of the street as being the dead side of the street. Dull business by day, at night too, chummies and slavies under the patronage of the late Father Matthew. Well, it still is the dull end of the street, I think. Father Matthew was the apostle of temperance.
They're sort of trolling the population there by putting a famous teetotal temperance leader in the middle of O'Connell Street. Doesn't seem like a natural home for him.
It doesn't, though, but I think that's one of the reasons these statues can stay here is because people don't actually know these things about them, isn't it?
Mm.
Continuing down O'Connell Street, heading south, and I'm getting to a statue which I think is going to be Sir John Gray, proprietor of the Freeman's Journal, chairman of the Dublin Corporation Waterworks Committee 1863 to 1875, during which period, preeminently through his exertions, the Bartry water supply was introduced to the city and suburbs. Seems that it should be a name that should be in greater circulation. Even in Ulysses, he's only mentioned in passing, but Leopold Bloom is carrying around a copy of the Freeman's Journal all day in his pocket. and the Freeman's Journal is referenced pretty frequently throughout the book. As for Sir John Grey, he doesn't really get a look in, so you get the feeling that maybe Joyce was not a fan of this character, his mom. I mean, as for all of these statues, just looking at them, they don't really inspire. I think that's the problem with these statues in contemporary life. And then the great liberator, Daniel O'Connell.
Mm-hmm.
The huge cloaked liberator's form is how he's referred to in Ulysses.
Because it's really immense, isn't it? Like, that's a chunky statue.
Yeah, it's huge.
I find those kind of particular scale of statue quite interesting, because when you're far away from it, it doesn't look so large. And when you get close to it, you can't really see what's going on in it. It's a bit squat, and it doesn't reach up into the sky like the spire, which we just sort of ignored on our way down. Because the spire is like a contemporary version of what public statuary should be like.
I agree. I love the spire. I think it's an excellent example of contemporary statuism or monument. I think it's really interesting looking and unique, and it really represents a moment in time.
Yeah. What moment?
The time when everyone had too much money.
I mean, is it like a folly then, I suppose?
Well, I actually think it's a nice looking statue. I mean, I know a lot of people don't like it, but I think it can be seen as representing that moneyed time. But actually, it costs very little, and I think it was a good use of public money. It's a really excellent wayfinder.
Yeah. Well, that's very interesting, because in Ulysses, we're talking about all these statues kind of providing a route that literary tourists and journalists can follow around the city. But of course, they can also now, which he wouldn't have been able to do, orientate themselves by that huge spire.
And the scale of it is really great for Dublin, which is so low.
Yeah.
It really sticks out in a nice way, I think.
The funny thing, of course, is that we were complaining about the statues being a bit opaque, but the actual meaning of the spire is completely gone. You know, all those kind of socio-economic historical moments will become completely opaque. It won't represent any moment at all, because people will have no idea the difference between 2008 and 2020, I'm imagining. They do tell you about history, but it's much harder to decode what they're telling you.
Yeah, I guess they're more abstract. You maybe had to be a part of that time to fully understand what they mean. You and I will remember, you know, that time and know that that's a great representative of it, but the children of today won't.
Mm.
But maybe that's what makes these things stand a longer test of time, is that they're not, you know, totally tied to something, and they can be interpreted differently if necessary.
Mm.
Whereas these figures are very much one-dimensional.
Anya Gallagher there, getting her steps in around Bloom's Dublin One. And next, Cork is our playground, as we tentatively go looking for the answer to questions such as, how do you make live theatre and follow COVID health regulations? Corka Dorka Theatre Company's answer to some of the COVID questions comes in the form of Contact, a short, non-verbal travelling theatre show now being showcased at various locations around Cork City. After Zooming with Corka Dorka's Aideen O'Donoghue, Rachel Andrews got into her car and zoomed off to catch a performance and paint Culturefile a word picture of the silent, socially distanced show.
I've arrived at the green area in Clark's Road in Ballyvihan, so that's the suburb of Cork City, and it's about 9:45, and the performance is supposed to start in 15 minutes. It's very quiet at the moment, so I can just see some gentlemen in high-vis vests. I think they're here, and masks. I think they're here to mitigate against any mass gathering. But they're residents, so there's like about 20 to... actually about 40 houses scattered around this green area, and they've all been told that the performance is happening, but nobody else has been told, so Corcadorca hasn't publicised it. So these are really just pop-up performances. And the green area has just been mowed, so it looks like freshly mowed grass, which is nice. We're not allowed to walk onto the green area. And there's just some big trees on the green. And I'm waiting for the performance to start.
Hey, Bob, I'm looking at what Jack was talking about.
People from the community step outside of their houses, move onto the footpaths. They stand apart. Some of them wear masks. They watch the green area, waiting to see. Then a van pulls up. And a theatre crew steps out. They wear protective white suits. Their hands are gloved. They have goggles. They wear a torch on their heads. In the centre of the green area, they place lights. They lay wooden benches, and the benches have lights inside of them. They construct a large perspex screen, pull it to a standing position.
There's this massive wave of the digitalising of theatre at the moment, and it's in danger. It's not the only thing, but it is in danger of quenching what theatre is, which is a live experience. So it's a wonderful thing for morale to see everybody putting plays up online for free so the audience can access them and see how wonderful they are. But we wanted to try and make something totally within the restrictions of social distancing, totally, you know, respecting that, and maybe bringing a live experience to people and they can watch from their own homes. So it's going to be in greens and outdoor places where people can receive a moment of theatre, and it's not on a screen, and it's about human connection. It's just a little meditation or a little homage to human connection.
This is soundless physical theatre. No soundscape either, because it's so late. It's just gone 10 here now and it's getting a bit dark. Beautiful sky, little flecks of pink just coming over the clouds, which are starting to grey. The trees blowing against it. And I suppose a crowd of about maybe 30 people have come out of their houses. Maybe more inside, of course. Okay, so I think it started, and I can see one of the actors arriving. And they've someone walking along beside her in the PPE gear, shining a spotlight on her. That's amazing. So big gestures. Oh, here's another one. So she's being sprayed by one of the lice men. Ooh. And so is he on the other side. Another of the performers has arrived who's also being sprayed. And so the light's shining on him and the spray is like filtering around him.
A car pulls up. A man steps out. Dressed in bright orange, he carries a parcel. On the opposite side of the field, there is a woman in vibrant blue. She too carries a parcel. They see each other, they make the acknowledgement. Then slowly, hesitantly, they begin their approach. Then the parcels are opened and they both have balloons. They are large, red, heart-shaped. They float on their strings as the man and the woman stand on either side of the perspex screen. The duo begin to move in tandem. Hand placed against hand, the screen between them. They glide and dance, they are in sync, but they cannot make contact. They let the balloons rise until they reach the top of the screen. Then gently, briefly, heartbreakingly, the two balloons reach out and touch.
This project is important to do now, live, about human contact while we're still going through this crazy time where our connection is so strange. For the future, with regard to digitalization and Zoom and all of that kind of thing. I can only speak for myself. I am open to innovation, and I'm sure we'll have to adapt in a million and one ways. But the reason I'm a theatre artist is because of the live aspects of, you know, it's different every night. There's a different audience every night. That co-creation with the live audience is to me the most incredible feeling in the world.
So very simple and very beautiful. And I think that will have given the community a little bit of a lift. It certainly gave me a little bit of a lift. And they're off to a different location now for an 11 o'clock show.
Rachel Andrews there reporting from the Ballyfihan performance of Contact. And you heard also from Corker Dorker's Aideen O'Donoghue. Contact continues from the 18th to the 21st of June at various pop-up locations across Cork City. Dreams of Aleppo power the work of Dublin-based architect and teacher Mohammed Ashour. Ashour's dream of his native city, which he left many years ago, surfaces in a new exhibition called Imagine, that he and other members of the group Art Nomads have mounted in conjunction with Christchurch Cathedral as part of this week's World Refugee Week. He spoke to Culture File's Anya Gallagher about the exhibition and his dreams of remaking Aleppo as a new sustainable city.
My name is Mohammed Ashour. I grew up in Aleppo and studied architecture there before relocating to Dublin, where I work now at Dublin City University as a teaching assistant. Imagine. It's the second exhibition of a group of artists. We did it with an idea of a virtual tour. Each artist sent his digital artworks, but we suggest to them to relate to the idea of Imagine, the theme for these exhibitions. It's various kind of artworks, painting, poets, and for me, architectural drawing. The title of my art piece is Heaven. As the theme for the refugee weeks is Imagine, so I imagined myself flying back, soaring over the river, enjoying watching these elements of heaven. So I use video techniques to present as a video to make people feel that they are swift flying over the river and watching these lovely places and spaces. I am here in Ireland, so I believe that this is my home now. But also, if I want to imagine idea of my home in Ireland, and also I have my other home in Aleppo. Aleppo buildings and architecture is destroyed through the last years. We have a lot to do, but when I say a lot to do, maybe a lot to create, a lot to design. And we can start from now. I used to say this and people just argue me that just be realistic. Okay, I can be realistic. I can now from my laptop, from my AutoCAD software to draw, and I can draw with my sketchbook. And I make a plan and make designs with my imagination. And I believe that one day the war will be ended, and one day the resources will be there, and one day the construction companies will start. So why I can't start from now? So let's start from now thinking about reconstruction and trying not people from Aleppo, even with the people who migrate, who traveled, and they know a lot about Aleppo. So all are welcome to join this, putting this idea, which might be I used to call it with my Irish friends a virtual Aleppo. The main issue is the local resources. So to have sustainable cities, you have to think about the local resources to save energy. And the other things, it's the idea of the community. We can't have one example. So the cultural things, the community starts from them. Then we can think about how to make this neighborhood a sustainable neighborhood or livable neighborhoods.
Mohamed Ashour there talking to Áine Gallagher, and Imagine, the virtual exhibition, can be viewed at christchurchcathedral.ie/imagine. And finally, on the Culture File Weekly, we are with our no longer locked down in Kilkenny correspondent, Maurice Gohan, who I usually introduce as comedian and writer. Well, not this time. Happenings of the last few weeks have knocked a lot of the comedian out of Maurice. It's not just that it's hard to write jokes about the events that ignited the uprising in America and beyond. Comedy is always hard, but sometimes comedy isn't completely right. So this time, Maurice has been wondering, does she and other Irish people too casually give ourselves the all clear when it comes to racism?
As the old saying goes, as one pandemic closes its doors, another one opens right up. As coronavirus is wrapping up its stint on Earth, the temporary unity and solidarity we felt is also fading. And we're reminded of how awful we can treat each other. The United States has been in what seems like could be the early stages of civil war for around 3 weeks now.
We're going to begin tonight with breaking news, with the nation on edge and in the middle of another night of protests. Tonight, the president says he is calling up, quote, thousands and thousands of heavily armed soldiers in Washington and calling on all of the nation's governors to deploy the National Guard to, quote, dominate the streets.
As we all know, on May 25th, George Floyd, a black man in America, was accused of having a fake $20 bill. You know who else is fake money? All of us. Money isn't real. Some guys in suits just printed, and sometimes they print more because some other guys in suits show them graphs telling them it's a good idea. Capitalism is a lie and money isn't real. But what happened to George Floyd after that was very real. Three officers leaned their weight on his body, most notably his neck, for 9 minutes. 9 minutes is a really long time. That last sentence I said took just 10 seconds. Imagine 55 more. There were 560 seconds for them to let him live. Instead, they killed him. They killed an unarmed citizen who wasn't resisting in broad daylight during a pandemic. And it wasn't even an anomaly. American police have been brutalizing and killing unarmed black people for a really long time. As Irish people, it's hard to wrap our heads around the systematic abuse of power that American police wield. The Gardaí aren't scary. They let us take photos in their hats. They crack jokes. When my cousin was stopped for speeding, the guard asked him, "Are you a pilot? Because you were bloody flying down that road." I know they're not perfect, but no one is afraid of dying if they're stopped by the Gardaí. As Irish, we're part of a white people loophole. We've never repressed anyone. We've only been repressed. There's people listening to this who remember when you walked onto a plane with red hair and pale skin and you were profiled. British police would assault and terrorize Irish people regularly. We've had 4 different bloody Sundays. And that's only in the lifetime of people alive today. We've been oppressed for centuries. We have oppression written in our DNA. So I do think we have an inherent connection to minorities who are experiencing systematic violence and persecution. We were known as the Blacks of Europe, I remember telling a comedian friend of mine while I was living in LA. "I know," he replied. "No blacks, no dogs, no Irish." And we high-fived. And then he described hardship I've never heard of. The first time he learned being black was a negative, at 6 years old, when the newsagent man accused him of stealing a pack of Twizzlers because your kind is always at that shit. Being pulled over by the cops with his white girlfriend, body slammed against the car, the crime he committed just being black. Being viewed as a threatening man by middle-aged women when he was 12 years old, still playing Pokemon. Always, always being alert, because bad stuff can happen at any moment just because he's black. I didn't understand any of that. And really, I still don't. I lived in America for 2 years. When the police stopped me for being drunk on the street, they made jokes and gave me a ride home. I wonder what the outcome would have been if I wasn't white. We've seen the viral videos over the past few years, a keyhole into the injustice and racism in America. Black people don't get to have a barbecue or ask someone to put their dog on a leash without some Karen threatening to call the police. And then those police might murder them. I see all that and I think to myself, but I'm not one of those white people, right? I'm not a racist white woman who asks to speak to the manager, who says I'm being threatened by a black man when I don't get my own way. I'm Irish, I'm different. Except Irish people immigrated to America, and now there are Irish Americans perpetuating the same oppression we fought against. Irish Americans make up a big part of the police force that people are protesting and rioting against right now. Irish Americans are, or have been, part of the Trump administration. People like Mike Pence, John Kelly, Sean Spicer all identify as Irish. Irish Americans are part of the far-right movement. People like Sean Hannity and Bill O'Reilly. Irish Americans are probably Karens too. So what is our identity? Are we the white people who get invited to the cookout? Or are we the white people calling the police over the cookout taking place? I don't think we get to choose the former without acknowledging and condemning the latter. So what can we do? We are way too tiny to have any sort of sway politically or economically. What can Leo do? Threaten to not give his bouquet of shamrocks next Paddy's Day? Ban the export of Dairy Gold butter? We're very limited on a macro level, but we can do things individually, and we are. We are donating money to groups like Black Visions Collective, Reclaim the Block, and National Bail Aid, who are all credibly fighting against racism in America. Money talks. We can also look to our own doorstep and support abolishing direct provision and repealing the 27th Amendment. And we can keep talking about this, having the uncomfortable conversations with each other, with our friends and our families, about this systematic brutality against black people and what part we have in it, not just as the effect, but also the cause.
Maurice Gohan there on what to do next. And that brings to a close this edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll be back with more news from the struggle next Friday at 7. Till then, bye now.